He felt he should just breathe in the water, but he knew he would die if he did. As Evie had told him, children drowned all the time. He needed air. He wedged the chest between his legs, freeing his hands, and then grabbed Evie's arms and pulled her away from his belt. He pushed her up toward the surface, holding her by her boots. He felt the current tugging her away, but he held on fiercely, determined not to lose her. She was screaming. Even under the water, he could hear her voice. Bits of blackness drifted in front of his eyes. He was fading, falling asleep. He was drowning. He felt his muscles tingling and burning. They were near the opening where the water spilled out, he realized. A big square of light could be seen overhead. Owen felt peaceful as he stared at it. His lungs stopped burning. Everything slowed down and he felt one with the waters. Breathe. The thought didn't sound so frightening now. Owen opened his mouth. Evie was gone. He blinked in confusion. When had he let go of her? He heard the pattering of a fountain, could almost smell the scent of honeysuckle and other garden flowers. Strange that he could smell so deep underwater. Then strong hands grabbed him beneath his arms and pulled him up. His face broke the surface, and then air was suddenly filling his chest again. Delicious, yeasty air that made his bones sing.
Up, lad, up!
It was Mancini's voice. Owen spluttered dreamily and saw Evie clinging to the fat spy's neck, her hair dripping into her face. Her dress drooped as well, and she hung limply, looking too tired to move. She stared at Owen in relief, and he could tell she was struggling not to cry. Mancini hauled Owen up under his arm and started tromping back toward the stairs. The waters rushed around him, but enough had drained that it was down to his middle, and it appeared to have lost some of its power.
"Why the devil I should risk my life saving you two,"
the espion muttered darkly as he marched.
"Reckless, careless, stupid little urchins. I thought you were a water sprite, girl, but you're clearly not. A water sprite wouldn't have almost got herself drowned. How did you even know about this place? It was walled off for a reason."
Owen ignored the man's rant and stared at the water. It was draining past Mancini's knees now. Soon the treasure would be seen. He would prove to them it was real. They reached the bottom of the stairs, and Mancini dropped Owen like a heavy sack before turning around and sitting on the steps, breathing roughly.
"Too much work. This is too much. Goodness, children are always trying to kill themselves for naught. Why I should bother saving you is beyond me. We're all wet and drippy now. Ugh."
Evie rushed over to Owen and wrapped him in a tight hug. "How did you? How did you save us? What were you holding on to? It was like you had a boat anchor."
"It was the treasure,"
Owen gasped, wiping water from his face. He stared down at the draining cistern. The water had drained even lower than the steps.
"Treasure?"
Mancini said eagerly, looking at the water. There was nothing. Owen stepped off the stairs and searched the spot where they had originally landed. The cistern hole was above them. He kicked at the waters, splashing them, and saw nothing on the shimmering floor. Nothing.
"His wits are addled," Mancini said, still chuffing for breath.
Owen turned and looked at Evie pleadingly.
"I saw it," he insisted. "I felt it."
She stared at him, her face wilting. Then she rushed over and hugged him again and started to cry.
"I think Ratcliffe intends to murder the boy just as the princes were murdered. When the two brats ran off, I felt uneasy about them, so I hastened to follow. They had apparently discovered the way to the palace cistern. Ratcliffe found me observing them, and when I told him what was going on, a strange gleam came to his eye, and he hurried away. That made me even more uneasy, so I tried to call the children back, but they couldn't hear me. Shortly after, I heard screaming and broke down the door. The cistern waters were being drained into the river. I saved the children, dragging both of their soggy carcasses out of that pit. It took an hour to catch my breath afterward. I don't think it's a coincidence that it happened not long after Ratcliffe left me, and he meant, I think, to put the blame of their deaths on me. Well, two can throw the dice in a game of chance.
Dominique Mancini, Espion of the Palace Cistern. Chapter 30. Cursing. The entire palace was in an uproar when it was discovered that John Tunmore had escaped his cell. A search of the castle had been conducted throughout the night, and it was impossible for Owen to sleep amidst the torchlight and the racket of marching boots. His room was searched for the fugitive not once, but twice. He dared not visit Anchoret that night, for even the spy tunnels were being thoroughly searched. The king was in such a rage that everyone was on tenterhooks. Owen and Evie were both feeling the after-effects of the deadly peril from the previous day, and it was the first time Owen had ever known Evie to be quiet and soft-spoken. The two children stayed near each other during breakfast as the king ranted and raved, filling the air with blistering curses about the incompetence of his trusted servants, who stared at the king with open shock.
"And what have you learned thus far?"
the king demanded hotly, his cheeks flushed, his nostrils white with anger. He hadn't been shaved that morning, as he usually was, and his dark hair was untidy beneath his black felt hat. Ratcliffe looked almost desperate.
"From what I understand, Your Grace, he walked out of his cell on your orders."
The king's visage grew even fiercer.
"And why, by the bloody fountain, would I command his release, Dickon? Your people had him in the tower. Obviously, one of them let him go." "That's not true," Ratcliffe said. "There was a paper given to the guard with your seal on it. A note written in your own hand, as they said, demanding the release of the prisoner, explaining that he was on a secret embassy from you and his capture was all part of the ploy." "My lord," he said, his voice lowering, "I have four men who swear they read this note." "Then where is it, Ratcliffe? Show it to me."
A crumpled frown preceded the response.
"It was thrown into the fire, but four men... I don't care if a dozen men all swore they saw pigs fly,"
the king thundered.
"I did not order his release. My signet ring is on my hand, as you can see, and I assure you, Dickon, that I ordered no such thing. Why do I bother having an espion if you bungle everything? This palace is riddled with rat holes, tunnels, and scratching claws. I detest it. And I've heard from Berwick that the cistern went dry and we'll be hauling water from the river for days to refill it since the rains haven't started."
He wiped sweat from his face, his mouth twisted into a brooding scowl.
"Why am I surrounded by such ineptitude? Is there no man who can be true to his king?"
Ratcliffe's face blackened at the king's harsh words. His voice was thick with anger when he spoke again.
"I am doing the best I can," he seethed.
The king glared at him.
"It's not enough, Dickon. We've known each other for a long while, and I consider you a friend. Even our wives were friends. But friendship is not enough. This duty is beyond you, man. This is a load on the halter you aren't strong enough to pull." "Am I an ox, then?"
Ratcliffe stuttered, coming dangerously close to losing control of his tongue.
"You are whipping me like one."
King Severn muttered something under his breath. Owen and Evie were close enough to see his face, but not close enough to hear the words. He looked up at his espion lord with daggers in his eyes.
"I'm going to call on another man to take on the job, Ratcliffe. This blunder is too visible, too humiliating. I'll be the laughingstock in every court from here to Paizan. I had success at Ambion Hill, proved my right to rule through blood and the blessing of the fountain. But losing a notorious traitor from my own towers?"
He extended a gloved hand.
"Give me his book. I want Tunmore's book. I want to read his lies about me with my own eyes."
Ratcliffe's face contorted with fury.
"I beg you, Severn," he said in a groveling, impetuous tone, and tried to draw the king away from all the witnesses. His voice was angry, but pitched low enough not to be heard by the entire room of onlookers.
"Do not cast me aside, like you have others. I'm not Hastings. I'm not Bletchley. I'm not Kiskadden. You can trust me."
Owen stared at the king, hoping he did not believe the spymaster. Owen had seen Ratcliffe when the king wasn't around. He knew the disdainful way he treated others. When a man led others, he needed to earn their respect, not lord over them because of his rank. It was a lesson he'd learned from his father, who always treated his men with respect. In his head, it sounded like tiles were being set up to fall. He could almost hear the clicking sound of them.
"Give me the book,"
Severn insisted. Ratcliffe's face twisted with fury.
"I will fetch it."
"It's in your belt,"
the king snapped, his hand outstretched. Ratcliffe tugged it loose and thrust it into the king's hand. He was sulking now, his look so dark and stormy that Owen feared him even more.
"What about your journey? Are we still going into Westmarch as I planned?"
"We leave tomorrow,"
the king said, mollified somewhat. He turned the black-bound book over in his hand, examining the binding with curiosity.
"Tomorrow? It will take weeks before the household is ready to move.
I'm a soldier, Ratcliffe. You know that. I don't care how long it takes the household to follow us. I'm bringing an army with me to the west. Soldiers from the north are riding down even now. We will surprise Kiskadden with our numbers. The last time I ordered him into battle, he balked and refused to come to my aid until the bitter end. If he balks about joining us, it'll cost him dearly. I think I've learned enough lessons from Ambion Hill. It's time for me to do what I should have done months ago."
Owen didn't catch the king's meaning, but he could tell by his tone of voice that his parents were in trouble. He glanced nervously at his friend and saw her eyes darken with worry. They were doing their best to conceal themselves behind one of the food tables.
"You won't like what you read in it," Ratcliffe said, nodding at the book as if it were a living snake. "You won't care for it. Not at all."
"I am used to slander, Dickon."
His mouth began to twist with suppressed anger.
"I've been accused of seducing my niece, murdering my brother's sons, poisoning my wife."
He grunted with disgust.
"Remember the eclipse, Dickon? The eclipse that happened the day my wife died. I was blamed for that, too."
His voice had shrunk to almost a whisper.
"That, however, may have been my doing. My soul was black that day. And I am fountain-blessed."
A silence hung between the two men as they shared memories like a cup of bitter wine.
"My lord,"
Ratcliffe said, his voice so humble it was almost convincing.
"If you will but give me one more chance, let me prove my loyalty to you. I have no doubt that Trinneawee was behind Tunmore's disappearance. I wouldn't put it past her to have stolen your ring off your finger in the night."
The king looked at him coldly.
"That would be impossible,"
he said,
"for I did not sleep. I will not announce the change yet, Ratcliffe, but I will soon."
He tugged off one of his black gloves and stuffed it in his belt, then reached out a hand and clapped Ratcliffe's shoulder. His voice changed in pitch and tone.
"You've been loyal, Dickon. I value you. Truly I do."
Owen felt a ripple in the air, heard the murmuring churn of waters. He watched with fascination as the king opened himself up to the fountain, willing it into their presence, summoning it as he might summon a horse to be ridden.
"You will step down as head of the Espeon when I command it. You will curb your resentment and think on what you have learned from the experience. My brother always taught me that men should be lifted up to the point where they fail, but no further. You have ambition. You have many good capacities. You are a loyal advisor and friend. But this task is beyond you, and I must find another more capable to stand in your place. You will assist me in finding your replacement. This I charge you. This I command you.
Owen remembered how the king had used his power to command him to walk out of the sanctuary of Our Lady. He had felt the flow of the fountain all around him then, and he felt it now, too, even though the words were not directed at him. This time he was removed enough from the situation to observe the king's use of his power without being pulled into the current. He was impressed with how the king had dealt with the situation. He hadn't said anything untruthful or insincere, and he had not done it scoldingly or harshly.
"Look," Evie whispered in Owen's ear. "Mancini."
Owen turned and saw the fat Espeon approaching the king and Ratcliffe. He was gazing hungrily at the piles of food on the trestle tables, but he approached deliberately, one hand resting on his enormous belly. Ratcliffe's eyes were still clouded, but he was staring fixedly at the king, and he looked to be near tears. The king folded his arms and gave Mancini a shrewd look as the big man made his approach.
"Ah, the man who has increased the expenses of my kitchen," he said.
Mancini bowed with a flourish.
"Your grace honors me by noticing such trifling details,"
he said graciously.
"I do have an appetite, it is true. But what I hunger for more than honeyed bread and sack wine is gossip and secrets, and what I have just learned I thought your majesty would wish to know straight away."
Ratcliffe whirled at the sound of Mancini's voice, his face flushed with anger. It was known throughout the palace that he preferred for his underlings to report their news to him, and only him. Mancini was breaking protocol, and everyone in the room knew it. The king looked intrigued.
"What news, Master Mancini, Dominique Mancini? I'm Genovese, if you didn't know it. We love our food." "I didn't," he said, giving Ratcliffe an unidentifiable look. "Well, Your Grace, I thought you would wish to hear this straight away."
The big man took another step forward, pitching his voice softly so that it would not carry through the hall. Ratcliffe leaned forward, straining. Owen and Evie sidled a little closer.
"I thought it would be worth mentioning," Mancini continued, "that John Tunmore was spotted in the sanctuary of Our Lady conferring with the old queen. Well, she isn't that old, but she is the previous queen. I used to be stationed at Our Lady, Your Majesty, and have some acquaintances there who are not part of the Espeon. They thought I would be willing to pay for such news. Of course, I keep a purse of florins on my person for just such a moment."
He jiggled his coin purse and wagged his eyebrows at the king. The king's expression changed to wonderment and respect. He completely ignored Ratcliffe.
"How did he manage to get through the gate?"
the king demanded.
"Did he sneak away in disguise? The gatekeepers did not see anyone matching his description."
Mancini grinned, cocking his head conspiratorially.
"I understand he was seen disembarking from a little boat, Your Majesty. It is dangerous, as you know, maneuvering boats so near the falls, but that is what my contacts told me. There are many secret places here in the palace, as you know." "I do,"
the king agreed briskly with a hint of anger.
"Well, that explains the disappearance. What remains is to decide what we should do about it."
"He's claimed sanctuary,"
Ratcliffe interjected, shouldering his way into the conversation. The look of resentment on his face was implacable.
"There is nothing that can be done except guard the gates and wait for him to try and slip away. He'll hunker down there for months and try and lull us."
"This may be presumptuous,"
Mancini said delicately, interrupting Ratcliffe.
"But I have a suggestion."
The king chuckled and put a hand on Ratcliffe's shoulder.
"Let's hear him out."
"Your Grace, let me speak with him first. It would..."
"This is where you lack in understanding,"
the king cut him off.
"When you fear having underlings who are better than you, you drive away the most capable men. If you claim credit for their efforts, they resent you. Too often you keep your espion to yourself. This man clearly doesn't lack in ambition or presumption. Let him speak. Trust me, Dickon. I have my own opinions and always will. What is your advice, Mancini?
Owen saw a fleeting smile on Mancini's mouth, but it was gone faster than a blink.
My lord, the master who trained me put it this way. Men ought either to be indulged or utterly destroyed. If you merely offend them, they take vengeance. If you injure them greatly, they are unable to retaliate, so the injury done to a man ought to be such that vengeance cannot be feared. There are ways of removing people from sanctuary. I know men there who would... How shall I say this delicately?
Then don't say it delicately,
the king said with a snort. I know men who would pizzle in the fountain of Our Lady if you gave them a coin. If you say the word, my lord, Master Tunmore will be groveling before you in time for supper. The king brooded on Mancini's words.
The risk is too great, Ratcliffe hissed. If the people found out...
The people are always supposing one thing or another,
Mancini said with a shrug.
I like him, the king said, but I will not give you the order. Not yet. What is your current assignment, Mancini?
Owen stared at him. Seeing the change unfold before his eyes, the king didn't even realize that Mancini was part of Anchoret's plot to deceive him. Ratcliffe had the king's trust, but he had lost his confidence. Mancini was seen as having the capability to lead the espion, but he was not trustworthy.
An important role, I assure you, Mancini said stiffly, rocking on his heels. I'm overseeing the custody of that little boy, the one who has been listening in on this very conversation.
He gave Owen a little wave. The king turned and saw Owen and Evie hovering just behind his sight. Severn looked at Owen with surprise. And could that be approval?
A timely coincidence, the king said. Owen, you will join us when we leave tomorrow for Tadden Hall. We ride at first light. Be ready.
Chapter 31 The Assizes. It was after darkfall, and most of the kitchen had emptied, except for Leona and Drew, Berwick and Mancini, and Owen. Duke Horwath had taken his granddaughter with him earlier to another room in the palace for some reason. The boy's stomach was twisting with confused feelings as he considered how it would be to return to Tatton Hall. To soothe himself, he had been stacking an elaborate series of tiles for hours as he listened to the conversations ebb and flow in the kitchen. All anyone would talk about was the king's decision to hold the Assizes in the West. Evie had explained to him, since he did not know, that the Assizes was the annual event at which the king's justice was administered. Formal charges of treason would be debated by the Lord Justices of the realm, and Evie's grandfather, Duke Horwath, had been named the Chief Justice and would be presiding over the evidence and the court. While the lords and earls would offer recommendations to the king, it was King Severn who would decide the guilt and punishment meted out by the Assizes.
I don't see why I can't just ride in a wagon,
Mancini complained to Berwick.
It is not healthy for a man to get too much exercise.
Berwick snorted with derision.
The king said you'd ride at first light, and you will. I've heard the stable-master has fetched old Ribald from the mews to see Chio, Mancini. It's the only brute big enough, I think. But you're like as not to bounce off. My parts are very tender,
Mancini replied, holding his paunch.
I haven't ridden horseback in years. A wagon would suit me just fine, Berwick. Come now, you're the butler. Surely you can arrange something. My advice to you is to stop drinking sack wine from the cellars and start riding more horses,
Berwick replied sardonically.
I don't want your advice. I want a cart, a wagon, something. Faugh! You'd best be doing in the courtyard before the cock crows.
It may take the drawbridge winch to get you seated, but seat you we will. I have enough troubles of my own.
He waved the spy aside.
Leona, the stable hands have provender for the beasts, but the king will be eating his breakfast in the saddle.
I thought of that, and we'll have something ready.
No need. He'll stop for a pie from the local vendor as he rides out. Keep carting in water to refill the cistern. It won't rain for another month at the least, but the king plans to winter away from King Fountain. Time to put things in order, dismiss the extra staff, and prepare to hunker down for the snows.
Leona's husband, Drew, coughed into his fist.
There is a stock of firewood already prepared for the winters, and a few more trees to cut down besides. We'll be ready in case His Majesty changes his mind. Good man,
Berwick said with a sniff.
Now really, Master Berwick,
Mancini said in a whining voice.
I don't want to hear it, man. I've got troubles enough of my own. An entire household to move, and only a fortnight to move it in. We thought the Assizes would happen at King Fountain, but there's been a change, and now we all must obey. Be there before the cock crows, man. Dress warmly.
Mancini scowled.
I'll remember this, Berwick. Don't think that I won't. I grant you will. Any more threats from you, and the staff will forget your feathered mattress, or to empty your filthy chamber pot. Beware who you threaten, Mancini. Now I'm off.
He glanced at Owen, fidgeted a moment as if he wanted to say something, then nodded curtly and stalked out of the kitchen. Drew came over and tousled the boy's hair.
I'll miss you, Owen. Everyone talks about you, you know. Even outside the palace. The people know that you're fountain blessed. It will count for something.
His look was tender and sympathetic, which made Owen worry even more about what would happen at Tatton Hall. After giving a little pat to Owen's shoulder, Drew left the kitchen. It was late, and Leona had already concealed the tray with Anchoret's dinner, but she stayed in the kitchen to do some final tidying. Suddenly, the noise of footsteps rushing down the hall stairs broke the quiet of the room. Evie came running in, her dark hair wild, tear stains on her pink cheeks. Her nose was dripping, and she wiped it on her sleeve. It was already past time for her to be abed, and he hadn't seen her in hours. She looked frantic and worried, and the sight of her upset made Owen tremble with concern. In moments, she was kneeling at his side and pulling him into a frantic hug, half-sobbing on his shoulder.
"What happened?"
Owen said, pulling back a bit to look at her face. Her green-gray-blue eyes were filled with tears.
"Grandpapa says I can't come to the Assizes," she wailed. "He's sending me back north. Owen, this isn't fair. I want to be there when you see your parents. I want to help give you courage when you face the king. Owen."
Her face crumpled with misery, and she grabbed his hands, squeezing them so hard it hurt. He hadn't imagined that she wouldn't be going with him. Dread flooded him from head to foot. This would make it all so much worse.
"Grandpapa said," she sniffled, "that you'll be riding with him as you did when you came here. He doesn't want me to see. Not after Papa. Owen, what are they going to do with you?"
Owen felt tears in his own eyes. He'd never seen her so vulnerable.
"Not after Papa. I can't lose you. Not you too."
Her fingers tightened, their knuckles locking together.
"We're to be married. I thought that's why Grandpapa brought me here. But he said no, that the king might send your entire family over the falls."
She hung her head, sobbing uncontrollably.
"It's not fair. You didn't betray the king at Ambion Hill. It wasn't your fault. Oh, and I couldn't bear it. Losing Papa was hard enough. I've tried so hard to be brave, but I can't lose you too. And I won't even be there to see what happens to you. This isn't fair!" she shrieked.
Leona had rushed over to them, and began clucking and cooing softly as she wrapped her arms around Evie's shoulders.
There, there, my little girl. There, there. Shh. You must be brave. We must all be brave. Anchorette will help, you'll see. You're upsetting Owen, lass.
Owen felt his own tears streaming down his cheeks. His longing for his parents had been like an underground stream in his time at the palace, an undercurrent to all his other emotions, even though he resented them for letting him go, even though he had formed attachments to other people. But seeing Evie's grief made him feel selfish and stupid. He'd never even talked to her about her own troubles for more than a moment. And what she was saying... Well, it was as if he and his family were suspended over the edge of a waterfall. They could go under in an instant. The sound of boots came again, sturdier and heavier, and Owen recognized the set as her grandfather's and Ratcliffe's. Both men entered the kitchen together, one looking somber and grave, the other looking betrayed and aggrieved when he caught sight of Mancini.
No!
The girl shrieked when she saw her grandfather. She looked betrayed and miserable, yet she still had her spark of defiance and iron will.
I'm going too!
Ratcliffe sighed at the spectacle of emotion. He snorted to himself and folded his arms over his big chest, giving Horwath a pitying look.
You deal with the water sprite. That's your concern.
Horwath's brow furrowed.
She's my granddaughter. Mind that.
Horwath approached slowly, as if she were a skittish horse ready to bolt.
It's not fair, Grandpapa,
she wailed. She tugged on Owen's arm as if he were the anchor that would prevent her from being swept away.
Come, Lady Mortimer, Leona said. Don't shame your grandfather. Obey him.
She rounded on Leona as if she were an enemy.
My mother! "'Is Lady Mortimer,'
she said passionately, with a hint of malice.
"'I am Elizabeth Victoria Mortimer!'
"'Come,'
Duke Horwath said tenderly, kneeling down by the bench. He held out his hand to her, palm up, entreatingly.
"'Is Owen going to die?'
she squeaked, her voice full of sorrow. She looked up at her grandfather, tears spilling from her eyes. The Duke had a brave face, stern and calm, but his eyes were full of pain. He glanced at Owen and then back at his granddaughter.
I know not,
he whispered. That made it even worse. A black hole seemed to have opened up below Owen, threatening to swallow him. He remembered when he had first come to King Fountain, riding behind the Duke on his horse. The sense of abandonment... The loneliness, the fear of speaking to anyone.
Come, lass.
Duke Horwath prodded gently, his hand poised to accept hers. She stared at her grandfather, unable to resist his gentleness. He wouldn't force her. But if she did not obey him, a man born to rule, there would be consequences. There would be freedoms revoked, perhaps even estrangement. Owen saw the battle in her eyes, the guilt and anguish in her quivering pout. She finally stood and took her grandfather's hand. Ratcliffe snorted to himself and strode from the kitchen first. Owen thought his heart was going to break as he watched Evie start away from him. She glanced back once, her lips trembling. Leona, who was wiping her own eyes, patted Owen's shoulder comfortingly as another tear rolled down to the tip of his nose. Then suddenly Evie did something that startled them all. She grabbed her grandfather's dagger from his belt and yanked it loose. Then she pulled her hand free and marched back to Owen. Using her empty hand, she took the braid she had woven on the side of her head, the one with the white feather stuck in it, and sawed through the hair before anyone could stop her. She dropped the dagger and then gave Owen a final hug, pressing her moist lips to his cheek, thrusting the severed braid into his hands.
Be brave,
she hissed defiantly into his ear. Gone was the misery and despair. When she pulled back, her eyes burned into his with urgency, a will strong enough to crash into his own and topple his pieces. She squeezed the braid into his hands, her fingers digging deep into his flesh. Her lips were taut and fierce. She was wild with emotion. Then she kissed him one more time, turned, and marched back to her grandfather, kicking the dagger with her boot to send it clattering across the kitchen. Even Mancini stared at her in awe and respect as she left.
Ratcliffe hates me. It's clear enough to see. His power is ending, and another will rise to take his place. Myself, if all goes well. When a man is tottering on a ledge, sometimes a little push is all that's needed. He said the Espeon will be gathering at Holywell Inn when we reach Beestone. He told me because he did not believe I would be able to keep up with the others. I have no intention of keeping up with the others. He also implied there is news about the Kiskadens, both of the brat's parents, in Tunmore's book. If only I could get my hands on it to learn what it was. I have no doubt that Anchoret will expect me to steal it, if she hasn't already done so herself.
Dominique Mancini, Espion of the Palace Kitchen. Chapter 32. Weakness. After dark, it was only Owen and Mancini in the kitchen. The dim light in the room came from the flickering coals in the bread ovens and a single lantern hanging from a hook. Owen had finished building his masterpiece, but he did not want to knock it over. He felt that if the tiles did not fall, perhaps he would not have to leave in the morning for the West. Perhaps he would not face his fate and his family's. He stroked the braid of hair, feeling its softness and warmth. The little white feather reminded him of the time Ratcliffe had stormed into the sea of swirling goose down they'd unleashed in Evie's room. The memory of the feathers stuck to Ratcliffe's head almost made him laugh. But not even that could make him smile more than fleetingly, given the gloom of his predicament. Mancini sat where he always sat, his hands over his belt, his boot tapping slowly to some song on the floor. He was waiting for Anchoret. He looked rather pleased with himself.
"I've never really cared for children,"
Mancini said, either to himself or Owen, while nibbling on a fingernail.
"I would be a terrible father."
"I agree with you," Owen said darkly, just loud enough for the big man to hear it.
"My father used to whip me when I got my letters wrong. He was always pushing me to excel in languages, in law, in the scholarship. I only wanted to please him."
He sniffed, shaking his head.
"I only drink when I am bored, you know. When I lack things to engage my mind. I may return to Genovar when this is done. You would like it there, lad. There is lots of water for swimming." "I used to swim,"
he sighed again.
"Maybe I should have just let you drown."
Owen felt his stomach squirm as he stared at the man. Their eyes finally met when Mancini glanced at him. Neither of them spoke. It was nearly midnight when she finally came. The secret door slid open and Anchoret emerged holding a candle, like she had done that first night months ago. Owen rose from his seated posture and walked over. She looked pale, drawn, and weary, almost as if the small weight of the candle was burdensome to her.
"Did you get the book?"
Mancini asked her, a wry smile on his face. Anchoret shook her head and set the candle down. She ignored the tray of food completely. "The king is reading it right now. He read it all last night, too. He has hardly set it down." Mancini grunted.
"I suppose, then, that you want me to try and steal it."
Owen felt his insides twist with anger as he looked at the lazy spy. As if reading his thoughts, and perhaps she was, Anchoret gave him a sad, weary smile and gently stroked his hair. She smelled like faded roses.
"What's going to happen?" Owen whispered. "They're taking me home tomorrow, but I'm afraid to go."
She cupped his cheek.
I told you I would help you, Owen.
You told me you would help me, Mancini quipped. I don't know, boy. I think she's out of tricks this time.
He grunted and huffed and made it to his feet ponderously.
If you couldn't steal the book, how am I supposed to do it? Your game is about played out. There are too many pieces still on the king's side of the wiser board. Not enough on yours. Best to realize this one is over. You can't save the boy.
Owen turned and gave Mancini a blistering look. But he saw the cunning in Mancini's eyes. He was trying to provoke Anchorette into admitting or revealing something. A small smile flickered on her mouth.
You no longer want to help me, then? You think you can step into Ratcliffe's place on your own?
Mancini shrugged.
Actually, I do. The king pretty much dismissed him today. And what I know about foreign courts will be much more useful to him if all his enemies at home are dead.
He scratched the corner of his mouth.
His trust must be earned, Dominic, Anchorette insisted. He's been betrayed too many times. You are Genovese. It would take something incredible to change his opinion of you. But I am helping you, as I said I would. I need a conversation with John Tunmore. But that can't happen while he's in sanctuary.
Mancini chuckled.
I thought you were behind his escape.
Owen was surprised when she shook her head no.
Not directly. I just helped him unlock the door. And because of you, the king has Our Lady under constant guard. Theconius Tunmore has merely shifted his prison from one cell to another. He won't last long in there. He needs freedom. Are you ready for your next assignment, Dominic, or will you quit now?
He squinted, looking puzzled.
I think I am done, he said ominously. If you are pushing Tunmore to lead the Espion, then our interests no longer align.
The king will not trust Deconius Tunmore, Anchorette said. Have no doubt of that. We need to get that book.
Mancini shook his head.
Impossible.
She knelt down by Owen's side and rubbed his shoulder. She glanced over at Mancini.
You can never fully earn the king's trust, Mancini. There are too many barriers. But someday, Owen will lead the Espion. And he will need you, and you will need him. Your fates are entwined together. You must help the boy when I am gone.
Mancini looked shocked, his mouth hanging open.
But I thought we agreed that I would lead the Espion.
And you will, she said, smiling. Through Owen. The king is sending you with him, don't you see? It gives you permission to be near him, to advise him, to help him gain the information he needs to survive. I've wrapped your fates together in silk threads. You need each other to be successful. I won't be able to come with you.
Owen started in surprise.
You're not coming? I can't, Owen, she said. I'm very sick. It is difficult even coming down the steps into the kitchen. Mancini is going. He will help you, and you must help him.
Owen blinked back tears.
I don't want him to help me. You should have mentioned that down in the cistern, boy,
Mancini said sharply.
He already has, Anchorette said. Owen, he saved your life. He was the one who rushed down to save you. He was there for you. He pulled you and Elizabeth Victoria Mortimer from danger.
Mancini came closer, looming over them both.
I don't want to be saddled with this brat, he chuffed.
She looked up at him. He will not always be this small, Dominic.
She stroked Owen's hair again.
Do you remember the last time the fountain touched someone so young?
Mancini snorted.
That maid of Dunremy was a trick of the King of Aquitania.
No, Dominic, Anchorette said. She was fountain-blessed. She was just a little girl.
But she led that army that overthrew Ceredigion's influence in Aquitania. There are many who remember her. Duke Horwath remembers her. Her legend will last for centuries to come. Owen. Our Owen will be like that. Remember the Battle of Azenkeep. The King of Ceredigion defeated 20,000 and only lost 80 of his own men. He became the ruler of Aquitania when he married the princess and her father died. He was fountain-blessed. Mancini shook his head.
But we've only been pretending the boy is. You expect me to keep up the ruse forever? To continue to deceive the king into thinking the boy is something he's not? I couldn't possibly.
Anchoret closed her eyes, breathing softly as if she were in great pain.
You must, Dominique.
Because I tell you truly, the boy is fountain-blessed. She opened her eyes, piercing the spy with her gaze.
I know what I speak of. He can hear it. He can sense it. He must learn how to become what he has the potential to be, and for that he will need help. It really takes one who is fountain-blessed to teach another. Tanmore trained me. I won't be alive long enough to teach him that.
She turned to Owen, running her hand along his arm.
That is why the fountain sent me to you. From the very moment of your birth. Owen, it takes years to learn about your powers, to be able to control them, to fuel them. It takes a rigor of will and self-discipline that most simply do not have. That you can already tap into this, even slightly, is a sign you're just as special as I've always thought you were.
She gazed at the structure he had made out of the tiles, unable to hide a pleased smile.
But for someone like us, the rigor of it is not even work. We enjoy it.
Owen's heart was on fire. He grabbed the silk fabric of her dress, the lacings at her front.
You have to come. I can't do it without you. Please, Anchoret, please. I can't do this.
She gave him a sympathetic but firm look. Her hand rested on his shoulder.
You must, Owen.
Tears leaked from the corners of his eyes.
No! I've lost Elizabeth Victoria Mortimer. I've lost my parents. I can't lose you, too. I need your help. I won't know what to do if you are not around to tell me what to say.
The boy is right, Mancini said darkly. I'm a poor substitute for your cleverness. Besides, you have not upheld your end of the bargain. You promised me your story. You promised me the tale.
She sighed and patted Owen's shoulder with a trembling hand.
I gave him the story, she said to Mancini. If you want to learn it, you must keep him alive.
Mancini ground his teeth in frustration.
You tricked me.
No, she said. I always deliver what I promise, in my own way. But you of all people know it is a double pleasure to deceive the deceiver.
He gasped when she said this, and Owen didn't know why. The look he gave her was full of incredulity and respect. Something she had said had shot straight into his heart, leaving him flummoxed. Anchoret slowly rose. Mancini was stuttering.
You are the most duplicitous, the most conniving, the most scheming, the best spy I have ever met.
He gave her a grudging smile.
You've read my journal, even though it's written in Genovese ciphers.
She gave him a slight curtsy and a triumphant smile.
I'll be blessed, he replied with a belly laugh. Well, lad, I hope Tattenhall has a decent kitchen and a wine cellar. I'm off to bed.
He chuckled to himself as he staggered to the steps. When he was gone, Anchoret knelt again, looking Owen directly in the eyes.
There is something I didn't tell you,
Owen said nervously.
About the cistern.
What is it? She asked, smoothing the front of his tunic in a motherly way.
I've been there before with Evie. When I jumped into the water, I saw a treasure.
He told her of the treasure he had found. How at first he could not reach it, but then he clung to a chest to keep himself and Evie from being swept away in the flood. The Queen's poisoner listened carefully to his story, watching his face most intently. There was something about her keen interest that intrigued him. From the look in her eyes, it was as if he were sharing the most interesting story imaginable. She waited patiently until he was done, and then she grew serious.
"Was the treasure real, Anchoret?"
he asked her at the end of the story, hoping she would say yes. She reached out and rubbed the sides of his arms, holding him fast.
"That you can even see it means many things, Owen.
People see many things in the water, sometimes glimpses of the future, sometimes of their own death.
I don't know what you saw or why. I don't know if it's real or not. But I do believe the fountain is trying to speak to you. Your powers are blossoming even faster than I expected they would. Your life is about to change."
He wasn't sure he was ready for it.
"Please come with me," he begged her.
She licked her lips, then let out a painful breath. She gazed at the floor for a moment.
"I will try,"
she whispered, and Owen felt his heart jump with a thrill.
"You will? Oh, Anchoret,"
he gushed, throwing his arms around her neck and squeezing her in the biggest hug he had given her yet. She leaned into the hug, patting his hair. The panic he had felt rising all day began to subside.
"A wagon. A wagon. This bloody kingdom for a ride in a wagon."
Dominic Mancini, Espion of the Ribald Horse. Chapter 33. Strawberries. There was a great deal of mirth and amusement in the torch-lit yard as everyone watched Mancini try to mount his enormous horse. Owen wanted to stay and watch, but Duke Horwath had other ideas, and the boy could hardly insist otherwise. The final embers of the late summer heat wave were barely cooling. The night was dark, but still muggy, and Owen's jacket and hood were uncomfortable as he got situated behind the Duke's saddle. The king maneuvered his steed close to Horwath's.
"Where is Ratcliffe?"
Horwath asked gruffly. The king tugged one of his black gloves on more snugly.
"He rode ahead last night with several of the Espion to secure the way. What village are we stopping in tonight? Stony Stratford?"
The king snorted.
"I wouldn't dare. The Queen Dowager has a manor near there. That was where Bletchley warned me of her treachery 2 years ago."
His expression soured with the memory. Then he gave Horwath a pointed look.
"You must do your duty at the Assizes, my friend. Be ready. Loyalty binds me,"
replied the Duke, dipping his head in a nod. Owen wondered what the king had meant by duty, but even thinking about it made him sick with worry for his family. The clash of horseshoes on stone nearly drowned out the rushing noise of the waterfall as the king's men crossed the bridge to the island of Our Lady. Firelight gleamed in the sanctuary, but the new day was still hours from dawning. As they passed the gigantic sanctuary, Owen saw dozens of soldiers wearing the badge of the White Boar, patrolling the closed gates. Many dipped their pikes in salute to the king as he passed. There were no street vendors, no smoked sausages for sale, but Owen could see a few timid faces peeking at the entourage from behind drawn curtains. Soon the island and the city of King Fountain were behind them, and the world opened up into hills, woods, and roads. When Owen had traveled from Tadden Hall, the scenery had passed him in a blur. It was different now. Many of the men they were with carried the badge of the Duke of Horwath, the lion with the arrow piercing its mouth. And the symbol of the white boar was ever present. These were the king's soldiers, men who had fought with him at Ambion Hill. There were swords strapped to saddle harnesses. There were armor and shields. The host looked as if it was prepared to make or rebuff an attack. The pace was brutal and bone-jarring, and Owen kept fading in and out of consciousness as he clung to Evie's grandfather. At midday, they stopped in a copse of massive yew trees to rest their mounts and eat the provisions collected earlier from one of the many towns along the way. The trunks of the trees looked like they were made of massive cords wound up together into a huge rope that jutted straight up and sent out spear-like branches. Owen remembered from his reading that yew was the favored wood for making bows. This was what he thought of as he sat under the shadow of the giant tree and nibbled on a mincemeat pie that was cold and too peppery. Duke Horwath was next to him, silently gnawing on his meal and offering no conversation. He took a large gulp from a leather flask and then offered it to Owen, who accepted it gratefully to ease the burning of his tongue. Owen kept looking up at the massive trees, for there were many, and the smell was interesting. He liked being outdoors, and was a little jealous that Elizabeth Victoria Mortimer's father had taken her into the mountains of the north so often. Owen's father had lavished most of his fatherly attention on the older boys, treating Owen as if he were too delicate for hunting. "How old is this tree?" Owen asked the grizzled Duke. Horwath seemed surprised, not by the question, but that Owen had possessed the courage to ask it.
"Older than Ceredigion," he said gruffly.
Owen crinkled his nose.
"How can that be? How can a tree be older than the land?"
The Duke gave him an amused smile and brushed some crumbs from his silver goatee.
"Not the land, my boy. The kingdom. The tree is older than the kingdom. The Aquitanians came to this land almost 500 years ago and earned the right to rule by the sword. Less than 100 years ago, we did the same to them in their realm. Beat them bloody. And then they drove us out again."
He sighed and shook his head.
"The Maid of Domremy,"
Owen said softly, earning another curious look from the Duke. He frowned at the words and then nodded.
"I was a young lad myself, your age. I still remember her."
"How did she die?"
Owen asked, though he thought he knew. He had heard her story before Anchoret mentioned her. The Duke looked down at the ground, almost as if he were ashamed.
"They couldn't trust her fate to a waterfall, lad. Some said if she were put in a boat, she would step off it and walk back up the river and away from the falls. No, she met a winter's death. The only thing that can tame water is cold. It's the only thing that can make it sit still."
He wiped his bearded mouth again, lost in the distant past.
"She was taken to a high mountain and chained there, with only a shift. She lasted a few days, but then she died."
Owen wasn't hungry anymore. The thought of perishing on a frozen mountaintop made him shudder. The sound of boots crunching fallen detritus roused his attention. King Severn had joined them against the huge trunk of the muscled yew tree. The hours in the saddle seemed to have reinvigorated him, and he looked less sullen, more at peace.
"Telling the lad stories of the maid?"
the king asked with a wry smile. He unhooked his leather flask from his belt and tilted it high. After finishing his drink, he wiped his mouth on his forearm and gave a satisfied sigh.
"You are an old man, Steve. You lived those days, when a half-mad boy ruled Ceredigion. His uncle, though, he was the one with the power. There is always an uncle in these stories,"
he added with self-deprecating humor. Horwath chuckled softly.
"Aye, my lord. Are we truly staying at Tatton Hall?" "No, I wouldn't trust the lad's father so much. We'll be staying at the royal castle, Beestone. And we will summon Lord Kiskadden to attend us. And when he comes, well,
He paused, giving Owen a smirk.
We shall see, won't we? You aren't going to trust the Espion to that Genovese man.